If you're listening to 9 to Noon this morning on your smartphone, you can thank my next guest for having a big hand in that. Tony Fadell is an American engineer and designer who was instrumental in the creation of the iPod and iPhone during his time at Apple. In fact, he's often referred to as the father of the iPod and was co-creator of the iPhone, developing three generations of it. He went on to co-found Nest Labs with its revolutionary smart thermostat, which was eventually sold to Google for $3.2 billion in 2014. But while his career in Silicon Valley has had some spectacular highs, it's also had some lows. He spent his first decade in the Valley, quote, failing miserably, unquote. And it's the lessons learned the hard way of failed ventures and screw-ups as advice about sticking to your vision and backing yourself and your product that he's taken and compiled in a new book. It's called Build, an unorthodox guide to making things worth making. Tony Fadell is with us from Detroit, Michigan. Thanks very much for making time.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So this is a compilation of the stuff you've learned, the tips people kept asking you for in one place. But you've also, in the end, I think, found it a bit of a catharsis to look back over this career and its successes and
failures. Very much so. Very much so.
And what is it that stands out as some of the key factors in that success? I just hinted at one of them, things worth making.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of different things in the book. And, you know, it first starts with building yourself and then building your career, building a team, building a product, all the way through a company, and then actually leaving it, whether that's through a sale or what have you. So I touch on all of those different things in the book. But, you know, some of the most important ones, I think, is embracing failure and understanding failure is our best teacher. And the other one is really the story of why. If you're going to make anything in this world, whether that's your own company or your own product, or you're working for a company making something, you really have to understand the reason why you're making it, not just what you're making, but why it is and why it's important to that customer. And really understanding that, because most of the time, especially in the technology business, we only concentrate on the what. And too often, almost all the time, that's what the case is. And instead of focusing on the why and the pain that you're trying to solve with the product that you're creating.
And coming back from that enthusiasm that engineers and designers can have compared to their average customer, there's that great line about the colleague who said to you, "I just want an email that works. Nobody's going to care about the walking lemon." This was in your obsessed right. with an emoji, right?
Yeah, exactly. And these were emojis in 1991 at a company called General Magic. And I was there. I was, you know, 21, 22 at the time. And we were trying to make the iPhone just 15 years too early. So we were creating this thing. The Macintosh team left Apple, the people who created the Mac minus Steve Jobs, and we're creating this new handheld. And it was supposed to be what we know of as the iPhone today, but it was done in 1991 before the internet existed, before wireless email existed, before, you know, all of these different concepts. And it was a tremendous failure. But and we were doing things like emojis. We were doing walking lemons and smiley faces, all this stuff. In 1991, 92, 93. So it was all so early. But then obviously it ended up and we learned a lot from that disaster. It was probably a $500 to $700 million disaster back in that day. And it ultimately ended up to become the iPhone 15 years later.
That question of timing, it's extraordinary in this case because 15 years in the modern tech world is an entirety. I think it's about as long as we've had the smartphone, right? The iPhone.
iPhone's 15 years old this week.
There you go. It's a lifetime. So it must be frustrating. How do you deal with the fact that you have an idea or a concept that you can see working, but actually all the other building blocks aren't there? There's no social media, for example. We're not all living on our devices. Like, how, as an entrepreneur, did you manage that sense of we have this great idea, but it's not going to work right now?
Well, the biggest thing is there's a few things that you have to realize. One is the technology ready? Okay. And you could have, as you said, you might have the technology ready. But the other thing that's equally, if not more important, is society ready? And I don't mean all of society, but just certain, you know, subsets of society starting to feel the pain of what this solution or this product that you're bringing to market would feel, and can feel that they're feeling that pain, and you can bring a painkiller. So back in 1991, we didn't have email, really. We didn't have downloadable games and e-shopping and, you know, buying travel online and all these different things. It wasn't until, and you know, about 2005, where people had email and all of those different things and really understood how to use the web, and they wanted to take it on the go with them wherever they wanted. And that was the reason why it was successful. You know, the iPhone was successful at the right place at the right time. We had enough technology. It wasn't perfect yet. We didn't have great cameras or anything, but it was good enough for those early adopters who were already trying to, they were going on the road with an iPod for music and videos. They were going on with their laptops, and then they were taking their mobile phone. And the iPhone combined all three of those things together in 2007 to then solve the pain of taking those three devices with you wherever you wanted to go.
For our entrepreneurs listening, how important are those early adopters? You need them. They're your first customers. They are your best salespeople. But what is the link between the early adopters and ultimately mass market? Because that's an important business decision you're going to make.
Exactly. Absolutely. And there's this adoption curve, and that adoption curve is you go through the early adopters to the, you know, to the early majority and what have you. And what you have to look at is that you're designing a device for that majority, not just for the geeks. You're designing something that's going to solve the pain for many people, and you're creating generic kinds of functions for the whole wide mass of people. But it first starts with targeting those early adopters, but not giving them very geeky things, but giving them superpowers, giving them things that go, oh my God, this is amazing, and it's easy to use. And then they start telling their family and friends about it, because it's not just for geeks, it's for a wide audience, and they're your best marketers. So you have to make sure that it's not just, it might be early for masses, but it's a great tool and superpower for those geeks who will then go on and then market it for you.
Forgive me bouncing around between the personal and the business story and the concepts, but that's, the book's full of all of it. Can you tell me what you learned and learned personally from General Magic's failure? This is the first 10 years. These are all these brilliant ideas, but the timing being wrong, and what else was wrong? What did you learn from that, and what did you learn about your own resilience and perseverance?
Okay, so first and foremost, at General Magic, besides getting the technology and the timing wrong, what we also didn't have is we didn't have enough constraints. We were playing in a sandbox. All of us, you know, I was working for my heroes, and I was just following their lead. And they were like, oh, we're going to add this feature, we're going to add that feature, and it's going to be this amazing product. And I was just following along. And I wasn't asking the questions of why are we doing that? That's one. The second thing is we had no constraints. We thought we were going to ship in 1 year from when I joined. Then it turned to be 2 years, then 3 years, then 4 years. We were working on this thing for 4 years before it ever saw the light of day. And the internet came out at the same time, and we were totally off mark. So you have to also put good constraints on that. That means people, time, money, all the resources to make sure you get to market with something quickly enough before the market changes on you. So you don't have infinite time. Even if you have infinite money, you need to be able to constrain your time to get to ship something to those early customers, to get feedback from them, and continue to refine the direction and go back and forth from that. That's a big one. The other one for me personally, for perseverance, was, look, you have to understand failure is the best way of learning. We learn the wrong way in school, actually. When we're in school, we're taught if you fail, your life is over. You need to study all these things, you take the test, and you have to get great grades. Well, life is exactly the opposite. If you're doing something new and something that the world's never seen before, you're going to only be able to learn by doing. You're not going to be able to talk to experts, because there's no such thing as experts, because you're doing something the world's never seen. So you have to try. You will fail. And if you're not failing, that means you're not trying hard enough, because you're not actually doing something that's really different. So all of those things have to come together, and understand that even through the failures, you only fail if you just decide to give up and not learn through that failure and keep going. So you got to keep going through those failures and realize those dreams. And so for me, when General Magic failed, I kept going to build a device that I thought was going to be the right device. And it was sort of right. Then I kept going, and then it got the iPod. But everyone else ran off to the internet and did other things. I kept going at it because I really believed that this was going to be the future. And it turned out to be the iPhone, like I said, 15 years later. But it was through all of those lessons learned through all those years that allowed me to see clearly and help to design clearly the products such as the iPod and then ultimately Nest. Through those failures.
There's an element of apprenticeship too via Philips, where you're working on, you co-founded their mobile computing group. So that's what you're saying. You're persevering with the same idea, but you're adding to your skill base. You became a better manager. And you end up working with Steve Jobs in 2001. I think you first met actually at a birthday party.
Yes, that's right.
But let's talk about where Apple was at that stage and how important the iPod was, because there were some flagging fortunes.
So the Apple in 2001 was a very, very different place than we know it today. Apple in 2001 was, if it was lucky, had a 1% market share of the personal computer market in the US only and in Japan. It was not the Apple you know it today. It had $500 million in debt. Bill Gates had to actually give it a check, had to give it a loan. And to keep it going. And the company might have been worth $4 to $5 billion, depending on the day. Now we know Apple is worth trillions of dollars. Like, it's a whole different thing. So to be able to, for Steve to say, we're going to build something like the iPod when the company was suffering badly, so badly that Michael Dell said they should shut down Apple and give all the money back to the shareholders. To go and say, you're going to stop really focusing on the Mac, all the marketing, and put all the marketing on this thing called iPod in a consumer electronics category that Apple had never shipped a consumer electronics product, really. That was a very bold move to be able to do that back then, right? When everybody was very skeptical that Apple might not even last another couple of years.
It's another important part of the story and of your philosophy, in that the iPod didn't just revolutionize the way people listened to music, but the way they purchased it. And is that another part of the story? It is not just adding another product. It is changing an entire market or an entire consumer behavior.
Exactly. And it's all about the customer experience. And so if you think about it, you need to, you know, it was great to have, you know, 1,000 songs in your pocket with iPod. But what you needed to do was you had to take CDs. So literally CD discs, and put them in a computer, take the music off of them, put it onto the iPod. And it was a very cumbersome process. Well, that worked for some people who want to do, but what really they just wanted to do, because now people are getting Wi-Fi and faster internet, they just wanted to download them from the internet and put it right on the device. So we remove all that friction and having all that physical media. So the success of the iPod was the iPod plus iTunes, plus the iTunes Music Store. And those came together in the third generation iPod. And that's when it all took off. The first generations, two generations of the iPod, were somewhat successful, but they were only really for the Macintosh fans. It wasn't until the third generation where it blew up and it became the start of the Apple we know it today. And then ultimately, if there was no iPod, there would have been no iPhone. So that was the trajectory.
So it's back to that case again of you've got your early adopters, but really your eye has to be on the mass consumer. I think there was something like 18 iterations of the iPod that you oversaw, which is something else. You don't just move from one toy to the next. The iPhone story, though, is interesting, because this involved reversing how you were thinking about things and was the original idea that you would add a phone to an iPod. What happened over the course of time?
Well, so how that really transpired was, we know Apple now finally saw success. After probably 10, maybe 15 years, Apple was starting to see revenue growth. People were starting to pay attention. Apple retail stores are coming online. Retail, like big box stores, were starting to carry Apple equipment again. There was no retail. You know, people couldn't go into stores and buy Apple equipment. So things were going really well at Apple, and so much so that iPod was the majority of the revenue, depending on the quarter. 60 to 70% of all of Apple's revenue was coming from the iPod. But we had this really loud set of footsteps behind us, and that was the mobile phone industry was stomping boom, boom. And they had hundreds of millions of users, right? And there were upgrade cycles and they were starting to go, wait a second, we like what the iPod's doing. We could add music playback to the mobile phones and we could take that market away from them. And so that was an existential threat to Apple. Apple's doing great, but in 2, 3, 4 years, if the mobile phone industry started copying the iPod functionality, Apple could be in a real hole again. So what we decided to do was we were going to make an iPhone, or what we started first was an iPod Plus phone, which was the classic iPod, as you know, with the wheel and the display, but it would have a headset and a phone would be embedded in it. So we tried that, but we couldn't get it to work because the wheel, you couldn't input text or phone numbers very easy. It was like going back to the rotary phone back early in the 60s, 70s, 50s timeframe. So we tried the iPod Plus phone. That wasn't working. We were also creating a video, full screen video iPod, so that it didn't have any kind of buttons on it, but it had a virtual interface like what we use on an iPhone today. So you could get full screen video. And then on the Mac side, they were working on a touchscreen Macintosh, a multi-touch. So it was going to be like a tablet-like device. So all of those things, we had those three different projects going on, and those all combined into one thing that ultimately became the iPhone, because we knew that we had to watch out for the mobile phone industry that was coming for us. But it was a really tough decision. And the reason being was because we knew that the iPhone would cannibalize the iPod sales, right? So now here you have a successful iPod line, and now you're going to make a product. And the iPod was only out about 4 years at that point. We're now going to make a new product to actually kill off the iPod over time. Another incredibly tough decision, but that again set up the company for where it is today.
I still got my iPod, by the way. I'm just having problems charging it. The little charger block doesn't work. Let's come back to people then, and the people side of this, because Jobs was, sort of notoriously, what's the word? Could be notoriously difficult. And I want a little bit more about not just your relationship with him, but how you managed your relationship with him, or at times survived your relationship with him. You're in an industry that is breaking new ground. You're working with hundreds of people, from engineers and geeks, as you say, to the money men, and then to a particular personality like Steve Jobs. So speak to me a little bit more about how you need to be and manage yourself in such a high pressure environment.
Okay. Well, one is, I think that, there's a whole chapter about this in the book, and we won't go into that one, but there's you have to really understand the reason why difficult people are difficult. And sometimes difficult people are all about their ego, and other times difficult people are all about the mission they're on, and they want to do the right thing for the customer. And Steve was the latter. He pushed us, he pushed himself to do the right thing, as right as we could get it for the customer. It wasn't about his ego that he was being that way. And it was, when you knew that, you could easily understand why we were working so hard. It was for the right reasons. And so the whole team around it. Now, that didn't mean it was easy, but we had to work really hard to get those details right, to make it sing. Like when you took your first iPod out of the box or an iPhone and used it, it just felt like, oh my God, like, of course, duh. Like it just worked so well. And so Steve would push us on those details. We would work really hard. And there were times when he was wrong and we would have to push back, and we'd have to push really hard back to say, you're wrong, Steve, you're wrong. And we had to show him the data and the rationale behind it. And ultimately, as I said, and I put in the book, even if he made insane decisions, I knew after working with him long enough, sanity would prevail. If we worked on it, we could push back and get it to work with him and get the right decision to happen. So yes, it was difficult, but man, was it rewarding. And I would never, change those years for anything, because it was, we got to change the world multiple times.
And while you may have been his successor, or one of those who could have contested becoming his successor, what have you learned about which positions to seek and which not to?
Well, I think, really clearly you have to understand, everyone has that myth in their brain that, the media says is, oh, the CEO's the best, or you always have some kind of, oh, I have to get to that point. You really have to understand what you love to do and what you, because being in a position and it's a position that's not one that really works for you, just because it might work for the external world and it seems great. But if it doesn't work for you, you're putting yourself in a jail that you may not be successful at, that you may not want to do those extra hours every day. Just because you have the title doesn't mean you're going to like the job. So you have to really go with a position that you're going to learn in, and that you're really curious about, whatever it is you're working on, and you know that you're building on strengths that you have, and that you're not sacrificing something just for a title or for money. And so for me, I learned very quickly after, specifically like at Nest, of being a CEO and going through all of that, what I really love to do and what I don't. I love running teams and I love being a small company CEO, but a public company CEO, especially under these circumstances where you're more of a politician than you are actually a business person, may not be the most healthy place to be.
Wise words. Tony Fadell is our guest. Build, an unorthodox guide to making things worth making, is his story, a collection of all his wisdom over 3 decades in Silicon Valley, including key roles in the development of the iPhone and the iPod. And as he just mentioned to you then, Nest. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. So this is another product you're instrumental in creating, the Nest thermostat. And many people in New Zealand might not be so familiar with it, but in North America and Europe, a thermostat controls half a home's energy bill. And you wanted to upgrade them. I think the genesis might have been building your own home with your family, your own energy efficient home, and thinking not happy with what's on offer here. It is also, of course, another whole chapter in your career. So could you just tease out one or two of the key, I guess, lessons learned or experiences you had out of Nest? We'll talk about its sale a little bit later.
Well, at Nest specifically, it was all about the customer journey, the customer experience. One is thermostats. Thermostats are cool. They weren't cool, at least back then. They were ugly. They were, they were things that people try to hide away or paint over or just say, get them out of here. They were also confusing to use. But when you understand the pain that half of your energy bill every year is controlled by these devices that might be ugly or whatever, it was like, wait a second, this doesn't make any sense. And it's also hurting the planet if you waste energy. So it was all about a great consumer experience to allow you to install a beautiful looking thermostat, one that would be easy to use, that would be on your wall and help you automatically save energy. It would turn down when you're not there. It would turn on when you came home. It would automatically learn your temperatures that you liked by you just turning it up and down. You didn't even have to program it. So you could save, and in many homes, the Nest was paying for itself within a year, in some cases 2 years, or in some real big homes, it was paying for itself in literally months. And so it was all about getting a new relationship with the energy usage in your home so you could save money, be comfortable, and help the planet at the same time.
Perhaps one of the biggest lessons as I whiz through your book, Forgive Me, is that of the sale of Nest, a huge profit for you, and must have been one of the biggest for those times. And it also allowed you to get into your next sphere, which you still are doing a lot of, which is investing, a whole new investment vehicle. But the sale to Google, what are the lessons learned, I guess, for the future of Nest from what happened there?
Well, companies buy other companies for different reasons, and some of them buy them for small companies, and this is what Apple does, buy small teams with really interesting technology that they can apply to a product line. In the case of Google buying us, they were buying a whole business with sales and marketing and multiple product lines and all that other stuff. And the reason being is they wanted this type of technology and product line to add in because they believed in our mission, which was to, there's going to be this Internet of Things, all these different devices in your home. They're going to be connected to the Internet, and they're going to, make it more convenient and more fun to be, to be in your home. And so they wanted this big business. But when it comes with a big business, you have to have incredible leadership to help to integrate that team with a huge company. We were only 250, 300 people at the time. Google was 80,000 people. And to get that integration to happen, you need strong leadership on the acquiring company, by the acquiring company, to make sure that thing that goes well. And so we set out to do everything the right way, and it took us 5-6 months to work it out. But at the end of the day, the leadership moved on to other things and they didn't pay attention to us. And that's really what happened at the end, which is, you know, what our mission was, you know, was changed dramatically because leadership kind of lost interest or maybe didn't lose interest, but they found more interesting things to work on at Google because they had so much cash. And they were just like, oh, I'll buy this toy and I'll buy that toy. And they got distracted and they forgot that we didn't get the job done when they bought us. And you would think that for $3.2 billion, it would be important to them to make sure they did the right thing with shareholder money. But that wasn't quite the case.
You come to a really important point for us to finish on, which is the responsibilities of these large tech companies, which, to your point, have got larger and larger and larger, acquiring other companies, and particularly those in the social media realm. And while you have been involved in the development of some of our most exciting gadgets, you are less enamored in how they are being used in some cases. Social media, and particularly the next big revolution, we are told, in that space, the metaverse. In fact, you're quoted as saying, "F the metaverse." What's your issue with where things are heading?
Well, I look at this as, you know, I believe in augmented reality, AR, and virtual reality, VR. I believe in those technologies. I've seen them. I've used them. I've invested in companies that work with those technologies. When you have a company, Facebook/Meta, who's saying we are going to socially connect in the metaverse, we're going to dance in the metaverse, we're going to, you know, find our next mate in the metaverse, whatever it is, you have to go back and go, wait a second, how do we make social connection when we can't even look into the other person's eyes and see their emotions, see their feelings? We have had too much disintermediation in human connection, starting with text comments on blogs. We know how toxic those blog posts are, or those comments on the blog posts are, how toxic it can be on Twitter, or how toxic it can be on Instagram or other video sites. To say we're going to go in the metaverse and it's going to get all better when we can't even moderate the types of discussions we have in these other social networks that we have today, I don't understand how that's going to work. I don't see how it's going to work, especially when we disintermediate people, intermediate people more and more. What we need to do is strip away that, because most of the people, if they saw the person on the other side who they write that comment about or send that picture of or whatever, if they actually saw that person face to face, they wouldn't send the things they're sending. Right? Because they wouldn't do that to another human. They're doing it to what would be a cartoon character in the internet. But we've seen what pain that can cause. We see how it can tear apart social fabrics. This is the wrong thing. We should not be applying these technologies and trying to say we're going to get social connection in a metaverse. We need to take those brilliant brains and those scarce resources and apply them to problems that really exist, like climate change, not fabricating new problems or creating new problems in the metaverse to socially connect when we already know the problems that we have in these other mediums.
It's a fascinating book, Tony. Thanks for your time. Tony Fidel, Build, an Unorthodox Guide to Making Things Worth Making.